ever horrifying, the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol appeared in the moment we now know that it was far worse. The country was hours away from a full-blown constitutional crisis, not primarily because of the violence and mayhem inflicted by hundreds of President Donald Trump's supporters, but because of the actions of Donald Trump himself. In the days before the mob descended on the Capitol, a corollary attack, this one bloodless and legalistic, was playing out down the street in the White House, where Mr. Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and a lawyer named John Eastman huddled in the Oval Office, scheming to subvert the will of the American people by using legal sleight of hand. John Eastman's unusual visit was reported at the time, but a new book by the Washington Post journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa provides the details of his proposed six-point plan. It involved Vice President Mike Pence rejecting dozens of already certified electoral votes representing tens of millions of legally cast ballots, thus allowing Congress to install Donald Trump in a second term. Mike Pence ultimately refused to sign on, earning him the rage of Donald Trump and chants of "Hang Mike Pence" by the rioters, who erected a makeshift gallows on the National Mall. The fact that the scheme to overturn the election was highly unlikely to succeed is cold comfort. Donald Trump remains the most popular Republican in the country. Barring a serious health issue, the odds are good that he will be the party's nominee for president in 2024. He also remains as incapable of accepting defeat as he has ever been, which means the country faces a renewed risk of electoral subversion by Donald Trump and his supporters. Only next time, they will have learned from their mistakes. That leaves all Americans who care about preserving this republic with a clear task: reform the federal election law at the heart of Mr. Eastman's twisted ploy, and make it as hard as possible for anyone to pull a stunt like that again. The Electoral Count Act, which passed more than 130 years ago, was Congress's response to another dramatic presidential dispute, the election of 1876, in which the Republican Rutherford Hayes won the White House despite losing the popular vote to his Democratic opponent, Samuel Tilden. After Election Day, Samuel Tilden led in the popular vote and in the Electoral College, but the vote in three southern states, South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana, was marred by accusations of fraud and intimidation by both political parties. Various officials in each state certified competing slates of electors, one for Rutherford Hayes and the other one for Samuel Tilden. The Constitution said nothing about what to do in such a situation, so Congress established a 15-member commission to decide which electors to accept as valid. The commission consisted of 10 members of Congress, evenly divided between the two political parties, and 5 Supreme Court justices, 2 appointed by Democrats and 3 appointed by Republicans. Rutherford Hayes, the Republican candidate, won all the disputed electors, including one from Oregon, by an 8-7 vote, giving him victory in the Electoral College by just a single vote. Democrats were furious and began to filibuster the counting process, but they eventually accepted Rutherford Hayes' presidency in exchange for the withdrawal of the last remaining federal troops from the South, ending Reconstruction and beginning the era of Jim Crow, which would last until the middle of the 20th century. It was obvious that Congress needed clearer guidelines for deciding disputed electoral votes. In 1887, the Electoral Count Act became law, setting out procedures for the counting and certifying of electoral votes in the states and in Congress. By but the law contains numerous ambiguities and poorly drafted provisions. For instance, it permits a state legislature to appoint electors on its own, regardless of how the state's own citizens voted, if the state failed to make a choice on election day. But what does that mean? The law doesn't say. It also allows any objection to a state's electoral votes to be filed as long as just one senator and one member of the House put their names to it, triggering hours of debate, which is how senators like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley were able to gum up the works on 6th of January. A small minority of legal scholars have argued that key parts of the Electoral Count Act are unconstitutional, which was the basis of John Eastman's claim that Mike Pence could simply disregard the law and summarily reject electors of certain key battleground states. Nothing in the Constitution or federal law gives the Vice President this authority. The job of the Vice President is to open the envelopes and read out the results, and nothing more. Any reform of the Electoral Count Act should start there, by making it explicit that the Vice President's role on 6th of January is purely ministerial and doesn't include the power to rule on disputes over electors. The law should also be amended to allow states more time to arrive at a final count, so that any legal disputes can be resolved before the electors cast their ballots. The failed election provision should be restricted to natural disasters or terrorist attacks, and even then, it should be available only if there is no realistic way of conducting the election. Remember that in 2012, election was held just days after Hurricane Sandy lashed the East Coast, and yet all states were able to conduct their elections in full. This is another good argument for universal mail-in voting, which doesn't put voters at the mercy of the weather. The key point is that a close election, even a disputed election, is not a failed election. Finally, any objection to a state's electoral votes should have to clear a high bar. Rather than just one member of each chamber of Congress, it should require the assent of one quarter or more of each body. The grounds for an objection should be strictly limited to cases involving clear evidence of fraud or widespread voting irregularities. The threats to a free and fair presidential election don't come from Congress alone. Since 6th of January, Republican-led state legislatures have been clambering over one another to pass new laws making it easier to reject their own voters' will, and removing or neutralizing those officials who could stand in the way of a naked power grab, like Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, like he did when he resisted Donald Trump's personal plea to find just enough extra votes to flip the outcome in Georgia. How to ensure that frivolous objections are rejected while legitimate ones get a hearing? One approach would be to establish a panel of federal judges in each state to hear any challenges to the validity or accuracy of the state's election results. If the judges determine that the results are invalid, they would lay out their findings in writing and prevent the state from certifying the results. There is plenty more to be done to protect American elections from being stolen through subversion, like mandating the use of paper ballots that can be checked against reported results. Ideally, fixes like these would be adopted promptly by bipartisan majorities in Congress to convey to all Americans that both political parties are committed to a fair, transparent, and smooth vote-counting process. But for that to happen, the Republican Party would need to do a U-turn. Right now, some Republican leaders in Congress and the states have shown less interest in preventing election sabotage than in protecting and, in some cases, even venerating the saboteurs. Democrats should push through these reforms now and eliminate the filibuster if that's the only way to do so. If they hesitate, they should recall that a majority of the Republican caucus in the House, 139 members to be exact, along with 8 senators, continue to object to the certification of electoral votes even after the mob stormed the Capitol building. Time and distance from those events could have led to reflection and contrition on the part of those involved, but that's not so. Remember how, in the frantic days before 6th of January, Donald Trump insisted over and over again that Georgia's election was rife with large-scale voter fraud. Remember how he called on Mr. Raffensperger to start the process of decertifying the election and announce the true winner. Only those words aren't from last year. They actually appear in a letter that Donald Trump sent to Mr. Raffensperger just 2 weeks ago. Donald Trump may never stop trying to undermine American democracy. Those who value that democracy should never stop using every measure at their disposal to protect it.
The ocean of dua.
Al-Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam ziyaratan minni wa niyabatan an walidayni.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of زيارة إمام الحسين عليه السلام زيارة العاشوراء. So stay with us.
برئت إلى الله وإليكم منهم ومن أشياعهم وأتباعهم وأوليائهم يا أبا عبد الله إني سلم لمن سالمكم وحرب لمن حاربكم إلى يوم القيامة.
Regarding the part where the ziyara says إني سلم لمن سالمكم وحرب لمن حاربكم, I am at peace with who is at peace with you, and with war who is at war with you. We were having a look at some of the traditions in this regard to further understand the truth of friendship and enmity. We had a tradition from Imam Ali alayhi salam in the previous program mentioning our friends as our friend's friend, and our enemy's enemy. And in that tradition, our enemies were introduced as three groups: our enemies, the enemy of our friend, and the friend of our enemy. And the point is that this love and this hatred cannot unite if the person is not careful and continues in his life for Muawiyah, for example. He will truly hate Imam Ali alayhi salam, which is true blindness. That's why in a tradition, Imam Ali alayhi salam is telling to the man who is claiming to love Imam Ali and Muawiyah at the same time, either get well or blind. So if the man understands the reality of love of Muawiyah and abandons him, he would get well and will be able to see with both eyes. This statement of Imam Ali alayhi salam is revealing how powerful his speech is. Imam Ali alayhi salam in reality is telling the man that either you detach yourself from Muawiyah or you get blind. This is because Muawiyah's love has no religious basis at all. So we have many traditions that emphasize that tawalli without tabarri is incomplete. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was once told that so-and-so loves you, but is weak in expressing his dissociation from your enemies. Imam alayhi salam said, "Hayhat, this is far-fetched. كَذَبَ مَنِ ادَّعَى مَحَبَّتَنَا وَلَمْ يَتَبَرَّأْ مِنْ عَدُوِّنَا. He who claims our love but does not express his detachment from our enemy is a liar." And we have in our traditions that tawalli and tabarri together are introduced as the perfection of faith. Imam Ridha alayhi salam says, "The perfection of faith is in our friendship and detachment from our enemies." And the point is that by being aware that, for example, your enemy's enemy is your friend, you will be choosing your side more easily. You will be astute enough to distinguish the different war fronts. Because if you do not choose the right side, but fight even valiantly, apparently in the way of Allah, you are only getting further and further away from the truth, from the reality.
When people ask, "I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right," go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, "I'm confused," say, "Please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion." You will see it completely exemplifies. It clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is: do not allow tyranny, do not allow evil doing, do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah, he appreciates him, he understands his dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we are talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In a tradition, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, "Man ahabbana kana ma'ana aw ja'a ma'ana yawm al-qiyamah." Whosoever loves us will be with us or will come with us on the day of resurrection. This means that prior to fighting with some persons, you have to find the stance, and better say what they're fighting for. And this is extremely important for the human beings to know. And this is one of the fundamental reasons why Islam has made tawalli and tabarri obligatory, which is expressing friendship with the lovers of Allah and expressing hatred and detachment from Almighty Allah's enemies. That's why in our traditions we see clearly that faith is introduced as nothing other than love and hatred. So, dear listeners, expressing love and hatred is not personal. It's not related to oneself. It is based on a criterion which is haqq, or truth, or whatever leads to perfection. This is one important point to keep in our minds whenever we are expressing our hatred and our loves. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. We took great help from the book called The Sacred Effusion, available at al-islam.org. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين الروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran. Iran has long voiced concern over the covert presence of Israeli regime's proxies as well as Daesh terrorists near its northwestern borders. Tehran says the terrorists were brought into the region at the height of the 2020 conflicts between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Iran particularly accuses Israel of hatching plots in order to sow discord among Muslim nations, saying the regime sees its survival through creating insecurity. On Friday, Iran's army ground force launched a military drill codenamed Khaybar near the country's border with Azerbaijan and Armenia. The drill was attended by armored, artillery, drone, and electronic warfare units with aerial support from the Army's Airborne Division. Islamic Republic's armed forces regularly hold military exercises to increase their military prowess and preparedness. The drills also send a clear and powerful message to enemies against any acts that challenge Iran's security, sovereignty, and territorial integrity. On Sunday, during a virtual ceremony held for graduates of military academies in the capital, Tehran, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, warned countries against the consequences of relying on foreign powers to guarantee their security. Ayatollah Khamenei said the interference of foreign actors in the region is a source of discord and damage, calling on the regional states to follow the example of Iran for power and rationality.
Israel considers Iran its mortal enemy and will do whatever it can to strengthen any of Iran's neighbors and try to draw them away from any kind of alliance with Iran. So that's partly what this is all about. Now, Iran, of course, has every right to have military exercises in any part of its country that it wants to. So the fact that it's having them in its northern border near Azerbaijan is not surprising.
Iran has long criticized Azerbaijan's military ties with Israel, which include purchases of Israeli arms such as drones and other weapons that helped Baku gain the upper hand in the war with Armenia last year. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute think tank, Israel provided Azerbaijan with some $825 million in weapons between 2006 and 2019. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has expressed Tehran's concern about Israel and terrorist elements threatening the security of neighboring Azerbaijan. The Iranian diplomat highlighted the importance of mutual relations between Tehran and Baku in the context of neighborly relations and expressed dismay over the recent negative statements by the Republic of Azerbaijan. Last week, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps held a separate military exercise in the northwestern province of Ardabil. The drill drew criticism from Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, who said he was surprised by Iran's decision since it hadn't held maneuvers in the region for about three decades. However, Iran's foreign ministry reacted to Aliyev's remarks, saying the drill was meant to secure regional peace and security. Iran's foreign minister said Tehran will not tolerate Israel's presence near the country's borders and will take due measures against the regime's activities.
United States and Israel support anti-Iran terrorist groups. The United States openly supports the MEK, which is an anti-Iranian terrorist group. So the goal, of course, is to start a war that the Israeli regime and the U.S. regime will be able to say is the responsibility of Iran. This is not the case at all.
But why should Tehran hold a grudge against Tel Aviv? It has been an open secret that Israel, along with the United States, have been responsible for several instances of acts of sabotage against Iran's civilian nuclear program over the past decade. Also, Iran blames Israel and the U.S. for assassinating its top nuclear scientists in order to hamper its eye-catching advances. Israel also sees this as an opportunity to act against Iran militarily, although indirectly. Any moves that prompt secession from Iranian territory is something Israel welcomes. Yet, in Iran's eyes, that is just a pipe dream, as relayed through its military exercises. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has also said that holding military exercises by a state within its territory is part of its national sovereignty. The January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol during the Congress meeting to certify Joe Biden's presidential election victory revealed the deep division within the American society and political system. Now, months after the incident, a new poll has showcased the extreme divisions between the two major U.S. political parties, that are Democrats and Republicans. To find out how deep the divisions run, the University of Virginia Center for Politics and Project Home Fire surveyed 2012 voters during the summer. Half of the participants had voted for Donald Trump, and the other half for President Joe Biden. Not surprisingly, the results showed a country at ideological war with itself. The responses supporting the idea of forming two new countries out of red and blue states range from at least somewhat agree to strongly agree. Indeed, 52% of Trump voters and 41% of Biden voters expressed support for cleaving the country along political lines. The poll also found that 80% or more of both Biden and Trump voters fear the effects of the other party's policies. As a matter of fact, they said the opposing side presents a clear and present danger to American democracy. In addition, roughly 2 in 10 Trump and Biden voters strongly agreed with the idea of a president bypassing Congress or courts to take needed actions.
The real issue here is the weakening of democracy in the first place, which helps support or enable these notions of secession or mutual hatred.
Furthermore, a June poll found voters saw political division as the top issue the United States faces, beating out the COVID-19 pandemic, healthcare, and economic issues. If not dealt with properly and swiftly, the extreme division in the U.S. could turn into a full-blown crisis with dangerous ramifications. It could lead to incidents such as the January 6th attack on Capitol. On that day, a large number of Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol, where the U.S. Congress was meeting to certify Biden's presidential election win. Over 500 people have been arrested in connection with the attack. Also, about 140 officers from both the Capitol Police and the D.C. Department were injured. 4 people died in the attack, including a senior police officer. The U.S. also faces another challenge that is gaining steam, a national divorce. A Texas pro-independence group named the Texas Nationalist Movement is trying to push a referendum vote on the independence of the state, dubbed Texit. Also, support for the secession of California from the U.S., named Calexit, is rising. As of September 2020, the California pro-independence groups got approval again to collect petition signatures.
It's dangerous because what you have is one-third of the population who are increasingly convinced that the government is illegitimate. And when you have that, you also now have the mobilization of a section of these people to attack the very instruments of government.
Violence and secession are two probable outcomes of the continuation of the current trend within the U.S. political system. It's high time Washington came up with a plan to heal its fractured democracy, or watch its house of cards burn gradually.
The United States has seen several high-profile incidents of police violence and brutality in recent years, whose victims are mostly members of minority communities in America. The death of African-American George Floyd in May 2020 sparked a new wave of widespread protests not only in the U.S., but across the whole world. Following the incidents, a group of researchers has collected data about police killings in America over the span of about 40 years. The study published in the peer-reviewed Lancet Journal has found glaring discrepancies between figures reported by a governmental database and those compiled by open-source databases. According to the article, over half of all police-involved killings in the country have been either misclassified or unreported. Moreover, the researchers found that the governmental database misclassified nearly 60% of all fatal police encounters involving African Americans. The database is also reported to have missed 50% of all police-involved deaths of Hispanic people. The disproportionate police targeting of African Americans has been highlighted in previous research. However, the latest meta-analysis is considered as having the longest study period to date. Possible conflicts of interest have also been cited in the extensive research, as the authors noted that investigators are embedded inside police departments and can be discouraged from determining that the deaths are caused by police violence.
The U.S. government, the Department of Justice, the bureaucracies within the U.S. state are going to do everything they can to hide these because it's already bad, and the U.S. wants to maintain its veneer of being a progressive, awoke, a haven of social justice in the international community.
The paper highlighted the importance of increased use of open-source data collection to investigate acts of discrimination by the U.S. police. Targeted changes to policing and safety protocols were also cited as possible solutions to the increasingly pressing problem. In reality, however, many U.S. politicians seem to remain opposed to such changes. Last month, bipartisan talks in the United States Senate for a police reforms bill broke down without a deal. The bill was passed in the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives in March. The reforms, dubbed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, were proposed following the death of the African-American man at the hands of a white Minneapolis officer last year. The law would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. President Joe Biden accused Republicans of rejecting even modest reform.
They have something in stake in, you know, arresting disproportionately African-American communities. They have something in stake, be it personal prejudice or be it economic gain.
In such a political climate, the rising trend of killings isn't likely to be reversed anytime soon. That won't be good news for President Biden, who has a strong base of black voters.
Iran and Venezuela are deepening their economic cooperation despite U.S. pressures and sanctions. The 2.1 million barrel cargo of condensate supplied by the Iranian National Oil Company to Venezuela, the first of a swap deal between the two countries, began discharging this week. The condensate shipment arrived in Venezuelan waters late last week, aboard a large Iran-flagged crude tanker called Dino 1. The ship is owned and operated by the National Iranian Oil Company. The shipment comes amid a huge swap deal between the two allies. Venezuela has agreed to a key contract to swap its heavy oil for Iranian condensate that it can use to improve the quality of its crude. The agreement is reportedly planned to last for 6 months in its first phase, but could be extended. Venezuela seeks to use the Iranian condensate to mix it with its crude to improve the quality of the oil for exports. That would also allow Caracas to supply its lighter oil to refineries in the country to produce badly needed motor fuel.
Venezuela must have the lighter fuel, which Iran is able to provide, in order for its heavier fuel to even move through pipelines. So it's an essential trade. The U.S. has stopped Venezuela and has refused to provide it. In past years, decades, the U.S. provided this to Venezuela. Was normal exchange. It's been cut off by sanctions.
Iran's supply of condensate can help Venezuela to increase its crude exports, as the country needs the revenues to improve an economy that has suffered because of U.S. sanctions. The deal could be a breach of U.S. sanctions on both nations.
The sanctions on Iran, on Venezuela, on 39 countries in the world today are absolutely illegal, have no basis in international law. This is unilateral action by the U.S. government that targets any country where they're trying to orchestrate a regime change.
sanctions on Iran and Venezuela have made it difficult for both countries. That has spurred Iran to support Venezuela. U.S. sanctions programs not only forbid Americans from doing business with oil sectors of Iran and Venezuela, but also threaten to impose secondary sanctions against any non-U.S. person or entity that carries out transactions with either country's oil companies.
And it is a tactic, really it's a crime against humanity, it is a tactic to destabilize the economy of countries around the world. It is it's a tactic to create shortages and to stop the normal trade relations that exist among countries of the world. All of this has no basis in international law. It is just sheer thuggery.
Secondary sanctions can carry a range of penalties against those targeted, including cutting off access to the U.S. financial system, fines, or the freezing of U.S. assets. U.S. sanctions are often applied at the discretion of the administration in power. Earlier in September, the U.S. siege on Lebanon was broken after the country's resistance movement Hezbollah imported fuel from Iran via Syria.
And now countries around the world, and it's noteworthy Iran's role in standing up to the U.S. sanctions, in sending an important shipment of desperately needed fuel to Lebanon through Syria. There's three sanctioned countries, each being literally destabilized by U.S. efforts to sanction all exchange, all trade, and even all access to very needed, for Lebanon, very needed fuel.
The United States has imposed sanctions against Lebanon to pressure the country over the influence that Hezbollah wields in its political and military sectors. It appears that Iran's oil and energy deals with Venezuela and Lebanon have broken the U.S. hegemony on the global stage and has opened the way for independent and sovereign states to conduct business based on their mutual interests.
The Light.
Plastic pollution has become one of the most pressing environmental issues as disposable products overwhelm the world's ability to deal with them. Indonesian activists have come up with an idea to convince people to rethink their habits and say no to single-use bags and bottles. Environmentalists have created a museum made entirely from plastic waste in the town of Gresing in East Java. It took them 3 months to collect used plastic items, ranging from bottles and bags to sachets and straws. They were all assembled from polluted rivers and beaches. The centerpiece of this museum is a statue whose skirt is made from single-use sachets of household items. The museum has become a popular location for selfies and has received more than 400 visitors since it opened last month.
I will definitely change my life habits. For example, like when I go to the market or to a grocery store that provides a plastic bag, I will switch to a tote bag. And when I buy a drink, I will use a tumbler.
Environmentalists say the plan behind the exhibition was to send a message about the world's worsening ocean plastic crisis. The plastic problem is particularly acute in Indonesia, a nation that ranks second only behind China for its volume of plastics that end up in the seas.
People around the world celebrate the changing seasons in different ways. In the U.S., an annual pumpkin contest is held to kick off the fall season. Each year, farmers and vegetable enthusiasts from across the U.S. gather in New England for the competition. Anyone bringing the largest homegrown pumpkin gets the prize. This year, a man from Abington, Connecticut, got the prize for his pumpkin weighing more than 2,000 pounds. Alex Noel explains how he worked hard to produce that giant pumpkin.
A nearly unlimited amount of work goes into producing a 2,000-pound-plus pumpkin. I put about 1,000 hours a season into 2 to 3 giant pumpkins, and you're lucky to even get that many by the end of the year. I'm out out there watering, fertilizing, keeping excess water off if it's too rainy, which it was this year, spraying insecticides, spraying fungicides, pruning, training vines, propping up leaves at the end of the season, putting blankets on when it's cold out, heating cables, fans. I mean, the list goes on and on.
The New England Giant Pumpkin Way Off began at the Tufts Field Fair in 1984. That year, the winner showcased a pumpkin weighing 196 kilograms. The Way Off has received worldwide recognition, too. Syria's ancient city of Aleppo seems getting a taste of normalcy amid reconstruction efforts and the war-ravaged city. A Syrian historian has also been contributing to make the city regain its lost glory. Ala al-Sayed is working to faithfully restore the lost sections of Aleppo's old city. For that, he is using documents and clippings he himself saved during the early years of the conflict. He says he came up with the idea to digitalize those documents in 2013. Then he embarked on organizing newspapers, books, and pamphlets while scanning each one to add to his digital library. Following the liberation of Aleppo, Ala came back to the city and started renovating historic places which are on the World Heritage List. The North Dublin suburb of Howth has a new highly efficient firefighting crew. The group has 25 members, but none of them are human.
Howth was targeted by a lot of fire, and so there's a lot of gorse here, and it's prone, it's very flammable. The goats, on the other hand, love gorse, so it's a win-win in that sense. I suppose the project also focuses on the old Irish goat, defining their role as a functional biodiversity crew. They're a hard-working crew, they're up for the job, they're keen to do it. It also instills key conservation grazing principles to tackle fire prevention and habitat management and the control of invasive species. So it's the old Irish ladies that have the job to do here and are well able to do it.
The goats graze eagerly on the ample gorse bushes, which are highly inflammable and cause blazes in hot weather. The local council hopes their deployment will make Howth less susceptible to wildfires. Conservationists also hope that the project will contribute to the survival of the old Irish goats, which almost went extinct in the last century. Each member of the herd has a box around their neck with a built-in GPS device. If the goats stray too far, the gadget will ping and let the owner know.
Five Siberian tiger cubs born in a South Korean zoo have made their first public debut. The cubs were born at Everland Theme Park in Yongin in late June. Their birth brought joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts as they are listed as endangered species. Zookeepers say it's unusual for Siberian tigers to give birth to five babies at once. South Korean people selected the cubs' names through an online vote. Many exotic fruit plants need the tropical climate to grow, but Assyrian is producing nearly 100 types of tropical fruits at his backyard in a coastal city of Tartus. Mohammed Hassan's passion for agriculture is to the extent that he left his job in media to build a farm. He managed to create a tropical environment at his compound, and that was the reason behind his success in growing fruits that are rare in many parts of the world. In fact, he has turned his farm into what he likes to be described as a tropical cave.
I came across the world of tropical fruits as some of them existed here. Many immigrants also helped me on this path. They bought me special varieties from India, South America, the Caribbean and other countries, even China. Currently, we grow 93 types of fruits.
Hassan's success has encouraged other Tartus residents to create their own farms. The government is also assisting Hassan with his unique business. His farm is now open to tourists and visitors where they can taste the products. Hassan says he has bigger plans for the future and is thinking about using his tropical environment to raise and breed rainforest animals. In Brazil, paleontologists have discovered the fossilized remains of a dinosaur that lived roughly 70 million years ago.
It's a bipedal dinosaur with short arms, around 5 meters long, and it was at the top of the food chain in the period in which it lived. It was the predator at the time.
Paleontologists say the fossil suggests a dinosaur species known as Kurupi itata was a meat eater. They found the ancient predator's remains at one of Brazil's richest sites for dinosaur findings in the city of Sao Paulo. The first piece of Kurupi itata's fossil was unearthed during an excavation work in 2002. Until the completion of the research, a model of this species would be on display at Monte Alto's Museum of Paleontology. Experts believe the discovery would help scientists better understand paleontology on Brazilian lands. Most of us know the feeling of being moved by a work of art. A Kosovo artist tries to make us understand a form of political discourse through a mosaic of outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Alkent Pajogo has made a Merkel mosaic from seeds. The artist says he wished to thank the German leader for having been an example for all the women of the world. He says his work is also a tribute to the towering lady for the support she had given to his country, which declared its independence in 2008. Pajago was doing his work on the same day Germans were voting in the general elections to choose a successor to Merkel. Alkan Pajago holds 2 Guinness World Records for his giant mosaics made with seeds.
Technology plays an important role in our daily lives. This time, a French company has introduced a device to help the visually impaired to avoid obstacles. The smart electronic device detects obstacles and warns users with a beep. People with vision loss can install it on the top of their canes and receive information through headphones. The gadget helps people to dodge barriers on the ground and above that, for example, the open door of a truck.
If you hear the sound to the right, it means that the obstacle is on the right. If it is straight ahead, the obstacles are in front of you. So you change course according to what you hear. If you hear an obstacle to the left, you go to the right, and this way you can go around the obstacle.
The device costs around $2,300 and is now being used by hundreds of people in Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland.
Wally the walrus has risen to fame with his extensive travels around Europe. Now the giant mammal has added Iceland to his list of trips. Wally has previously visited France, Spain and the UK. His last known location before Iceland was Ireland. Scientists were not sure at first if they had indeed seen Wally, but Seal Rescue Ireland recognized him from scars on his front flippers. The wandering walrus is 4 years old and weighs about a ton. He has covered a distance of around 5,000 kilometers in his recent trips. Wally is now on his way towards his home in the Arctic. A French zoo has had a very productive year, welcoming multiple new animals into its collection. 2 pumas, 2 jaguars, 9 Peruvian squirrel monkeys, and even rarer, macaque twins are new additions to Lemmingme Zoo. this summer, the animals were bred as part of a program designed to maintain and promote the conservation of endangered species. Once they reach the breeding age, these animals will be transported to other zoos to help boost the population of their species.
Now, a museum in Russia's Kaliningrad has unveiled a special exhibition to the public. It would not be exactly wrong to call the artworks out of trash. All the works exhibited are made of rubbish. The exhibition is showcasing a wide array of objects, including sculptures, musical instruments, robots, and costumes. The project was designed with the aim of raising awareness about recycling. People visiting the exhibition were delighted by the creative use of garbage. Only 7% of waste is recycled in Russia each year, while a vast amount of trash is stored in landfills.
An Egyptian artist is making incredibly tiny statues of famous historical figures and landmarks on pencil tips. 30-year-old Ibrahim Balala is based in the city of Rashid, south of Cairo. He has mastered the art of crafting miniature sculptures. Ibrahim mostly creates statues of Egyptian pharaohs, but Islamic, Greek, and Roman figures also feature in his portfolio. The artist received some criticism when he first ventured on his art, but he persevered and rose to prominence with his minuscule statues. Ibrahim's dream is to open a museum of miniature sculptures someday.
Fourteen lucky penguins have been returned to the seas off the Atlantic coast of Argentina after rehabilitating them from malnutrition and hypothermia. The Magellanic penguins waddled back happily into the chilly waters once they were released. They were distressed, malnourished, and dehydrated when they were found by conservationists in February. There are an estimated 2 to 3 million Magellanic penguins in the world. The cute birds are named after Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan. They are mostly found around Argentina and Chile.
Another groundbreaking archaeological discovery in Peru is now catching attention. 800-year-old human remains south of the capital, Lima, highlight the ancient burial rituals in the South American country. The remains of 8 adults and children buried in a common tomb were found by a group of workers laying gas pipes at the site. They were buried with food, dishes, and musical instruments, including flutes. Archaeologists say that the 8 people lived in the ancient town of Chitka, some 60 kilometers from Lima. They say some of the bodies were buried with the shells on their heads and had bags with cocoa leaves inside them. They say the discovery will shed more light on the pre-Hispanic history of the region. Another 30 human remains have been discovered in Chilca in 2018.
A taxi company in Thailand has turned its vehicles into mini vegetable gardens to help its drivers who are out of work due to the coronavirus pandemic.
The point of this project is so that employees have something to do to reduce stress. To a certain extent, it has helped with reducing our stress, but it isn't really the answer to the situation right now. Even though the drivers and the staff are able to harvest the vegetables for food, it's just part of solving the problem. I think the government should also step in to help us too.
The taxi company is growing vegetables on the roofs and hoods of 300 disused taxis that are parked idly. Prolonged COVID-19 lockdowns have affected the drivers' income negatively so that they are unable to pay the lease of their vehicles. Therefore, working in these gardens has reduced their stress and provided the drivers and their families with food.
We are with you. What about you?